Thank you for inviting me and for that effusive introduction. I rarely get out to California. I thought Chicago was midway between California and New York, but it turned out differently when I was on the plane. It's a long trip here. I think I should be sleeping now, according to my watch. I'm going to be speaking this evening, not exactly on the title of the talk as it was advertised. I'm going to be speaking on a related topic, a kindred topic, namely on what I consider to be legitimate disagreements about the Israel-Palestine conflict versus illegitimate or concocted disagreements about the Israel-Palestine conflict. And I'm going to make the argument that, in fact, there's a broad agreement on most aspects of the Israel-Palestine conflict, and much of what passes for vehement, passionate disagreement regarding the Israel-Palestine conflict is actually contrived, it's concocted, it's fabricated, and its main purpose is to divert people from the real facts and the real issues. That's going to be the basic thesis of this evening's remarks. I'm going to begin on a somewhat autobiographical note, not because my personal history should be of any interest to anyone here, but for reasons which I think will become clear at the end of my remarks. I first became involved in the Israel-Palestine conflict in a public way at the time of Israel's invasion of Lebanon in June 1982. Up until then, I had been, as a young person, quite involved in politics, but not on the Israel-Palestine conflict. When Israel invaded Lebanon, I joined together with several other Jews. We formed a little group opposing the Israeli invasion in Lebanon. And at the time, I was also involved in discussion about various topics related to the Israel-Palestine conflict. And being that I was a member of a Jewish group, a topic that kept coming up, kept cropping up, was the question of Zionism. And sort of, are you now or have you ever been a Zionist? And are you an anti-Zionist or a non-Zionist? I frankly had read practically nothing on the topic. And when the issue arose, I like it to be the case that my politics are informed by my mind and not just by my heart. And so when the question came up of Zionism, I began to research the topic and read on it fairly extensively. At some point, probably about a year later, I realized that the topic was of sufficient interest that I might as well turn it into my doctoral dissertation. I was what was called, for anyone who's attended graduate school, a common initial ABD. I was all but dissertation, and I decided to turn the topic of Zionism into my doctoral dissertation. And about another year later, I had thought that I had completed the research on the topic. I had completed the research phase and was about to embark on the daunting task of the writing phase of the doctoral dissertation. And I can almost date exactly when this happened. It was roughly April or May 1984. It was just at that moment when I had thought that I completed the research phase of my doctoral dissertation. It was just at that moment that I walked into a bookstore for the publisher Harper and Row. Now it's called Harper Collins. At the time it was called Harper and Row. And Harper and Row, the publisher, had its own bookstore. I went in, and I remember still my mind's eye, the image is pretty vivid. There was sitting on the bookshelf, very prominently displayed, a newly released book entitled From Time Immemorial. And the subtitle was The Origins of the Arab, the subtitles of the Arab-Jewish conflict something like the Origins of the Arab-Jewish Conflict Over Palestine, I think, but I may have the subtitle wrong. In any event, it was a hefty volume, and I picked it up, and on the back it was endorsed by a very impressive array of figures. You could call it pretty much a who's who of American arts and letters. So you had Barbara Tuchman. Those of you who are a little bit older will remember her as a very prominent historian, having written Guns of August. Below her was Lucy Dawidowicz, the Holocaust historian at the time, the main Holocaust historian at the time. Then you had Nobel laureates like Saul Bellow, Elie Wiesel, and so on down the line. It was a very impressive roster of names, each promising more than the one that preceded, that this book was going to change our whole understanding of the Israel-Palestine conflict. The book rapidly became a national bestseller. It went into seven hardback printings, and it received reviews ranging from ecstasy to awe in the mainstream media. Martin Peretz, who was then and still is the editor and publisher of the New Republic, he said this book, if read, will change the history of the future. Barbara Tuchman, the person I mentioned earlier, the historian, said that the book is, quote, a historical event in itself. Well, those were pretty impressive blurbs, and I felt an obligation. Doctoral students are supposed to read the last word on the topic, and this was not only the last word on the topic, but it also promised to completely change our understanding of the topic. And indeed, the thesis of the book, were it correct, would have changed radically our understanding of the topic. The central thesis of the book was, it can be simply put, not complicated, the central thesis of the book was that Palestine was empty on the eve of Zionist colonization. The Jewish settlers came to Palestine, made the desert bloom, and after they made the desert bloom, Arabs from neighboring states sneaked into Palestine, surreptitiously entered Palestine to exploit the new economic opportunities, and then pretended to be, yep. Folks, let me make a suggestion. If you don't pay attention and just listen, everything will work out fine. Entered Palestine, and pretended to be indigenous to the region. And so the claim was, this was a kind of scientific proof that in fact, as Golda Meir had famously put it, there was no such thing as Palestinians. She meant it in a narrower cultural sense, but this was meant quite literally, that everybody who claimed to be Palestinian had fabricated collectively their genealogies. Now, I have to confess that even though many people, when the book was published, even though many people who were sympathetic to the Palestinians dismissed it out of hand as nonsense, I happen not to belong to that category. Not because I thought the thesis was true, but because I thought one has to be open to the possibility that things which you believe are true, which you're nearly certain are true, which all your experience and all your reading tell you are true, that those things may turn out to be false. I myself, as a youth, had very deep convictions on certain topics, had read extensively on those topics, and I was absolutely certain that my convictions and beliefs were correct. I was 101% certain. In fact, I was insufferably righteous about my convictions. And if I had any doubts about those convictions, there were people in eminent places of authority who shared my views. And so I would think as a young person, well, maybe I'm wrong, but could it be that X who taught at Harvard, or Y, who teaches at an elite institution in Paris, can they be wrong as well? Not possible. Well, as it happened, I was wrong. I'm not sure if I'm yet willing to concede how wrong I was, but certainly I was wrong in significant measure. And that experience was a humbling and, as they say, chastening and sobering experience for me. And the main thing I walked away from that experience with, was I'm not going to make a fool of myself again. It wasn't so much that I was wrong intellectually, it was a question of I felt personally compromised by having committed myself to something which was false. And so when the Joan Peters book came out, even though on its surface the thesis seemed preposterous, only because none of the scholarly literature supported it, even though on its surface it seemed preposterous, part of me said, well, maybe it's true, and maybe I'm wrong again. But this time, I'm not going to make myself a fool. I'll sit down, look through the book carefully, examine it closely, and see what I come up with. And so now for the next couple of months, it was almost like Captain Ahab and Moby Dick, with Joan Peters's From Time Immemorial filling in for Moby Dick. I went at the book with a, I think one can fairly say, I went at the book with a fanaticism. It had 1,850-something footnotes Joan Peters used to boast, and I went to the New York Public Library, one of the great research institutions in the world, sat down in their Office of Public Records, and started to go through those footnotes one by one by one. I was determined to find out for myself whether this was true. The core of the book was a demographic study which purported to demonstrate through lots of tables and numbers that the Palestinians weren't indigenous to Palestine. And the book had a large number of chapters at the heart of the book, and then all of these complicated, or what seemed to be complicated, tables in the back of the book. And I sat down, I'm pretty old-fashioned then as now, I refused to use calculators, and I sat down with a paper and pencil, and I'm going to figure out all the numbers and figure out whether what she's saying is right. And I remember one night I was working on it for several hours because the tables were very obscure, the prose was impenetrable, but I was going to get it. And I was determined. And it was around one night, it was around 1:30 in the morning, and suddenly my eyes started to water, the shiver down your spine. I discovered that the key number in the demographic study was a fraud. It was a hoax. There was no possibility it was an error. It was clear from the way the figures were arranged that the number was false. And, you know, it was, so to speak, it was not only a redeeming moment morally, but it was an exciting moment intellectually. A friend of mine, a famous economist who recently passed away, Paul Sweezy, some of you may know, he later said to me that discovering a fraud is every scholar's eureka. And this was my eureka moment. I lived in a very tiny studio in way upper Manhattan, and I started to pace the studio back and forth, going, I did it, I did it, I did it. And when you have moments like that, of course, to use that new age term, you want to share them with somebody. And it was 1:30 in the morning. I didn't know who to share it with. I didn't think Oprah would be too interested, but I am Jewish, so of course I called up my mother. And I rang her up and I told her, Mom, you won't believe it, I did it, I did it, I did it. And like a good Jewish mother, she said, I'm very proud of you, I'm very happy for you, what did you do? And it was impossible to explain the details except that I had discovered a fraud. And for the next several months, I went through the whole of the book, and it turned out that the entire book was a concoction from start to finish, and most people believe as well that the author's name was a concoction, not just the content of the book. And I completed the book by, excuse me, I completed the research by approximately December 1984, which, as you can gather, was not a particularly long period of time. It took me about several months to go through all of the footnotes and go through the demographic study. What turned into the real challenge, the real undertaking, was trying to publicize the fraud, because by this time, a huge number of mainstream institutions and individuals were invested in that book, invested in terms of their reputations. And they were not about to publicize the fact that a graduate student who had spent all of 2 years studying the topic, which was literally the case, I hadn't read barely anything before 82, a graduate student who had barely studied the topic was able to detect a fraud which all the important scholars and reviewers were not only not able to detect, but were raving about that very same book. And so it took about another 2 years, early 1986, before the fraud was finally publicly acknowledged, or I should say publicly, acknowledged, I think, is an appropriate word. There was a famous column by the New York Times columnist named Anthony Lewis. It was called There Were No Indians, and Lewis went through the whole history of the Peters fraud. And from there on in, roughly now 20 years, two decades of my life, those prime years, prime decades of one's life, I've devoted most of my political life to the Israel-Palestine conflict. And as anniversaries come around, or milestones, my milestone came around just around this time of roughly the last couple of years, where it was an occasion to reflect on what I had learned from two decades of study and reflection on the topic. And the main thing I think I learned, the main lesson I learned from all of the reflection and reading, is that it's a kind of underwhelming epiphany. You learn that, or I learned that, in fact, the conflict is not very complicated at all. It doesn't raise any particularly complex moral questions. It doesn't raise any particularly complex political questions. And it doesn't raise even particularly complex scholarly or historical questions. And in fact, especially now, especially say in the last 10 or 15 years, one can say that there's a broad consensus on the political level, the historical level, and on the human rights level about the Israel-Palestine conflict. And the question, as I said earlier, that I'm going to be posing this evening is a kind of paradoxical question. The question is, if what I'm saying is true, that there's a broad consensus on the political, on the historical, and the human rights issues, if what I'm saying is true, how then do you account for all the passionate, vehement controversy that surrounds the Israel-Palestine conflict? If people basically agree on the facts, the moral questions, and the political questions, why is there so much passion and heat surrounding the Israel-Palestine conflict? And the argument I'm going to make is because most of the passion and most of the heat has nothing whatever to do with the Israel-Palestine conflict. It's a concocted controversies and disagreements to distract people, divert people from the real issues. Let me briefly illustrate several of the points I made for reasons of clarification. As I said earlier, there was a time when there was serious dispute among scholars and historians about the roots and origins of the Israel-Palestine conflict. The fact of the matter, however, is basically that's no longer the case. There are narrow areas where people disagree in the historical and scholarly literature. And I'll give an illustration later. But not any longer on the big questions and even the questions of detail. Most scholars, most historians agree. As I said, this wasn't always the case. Let's take a concrete example. Let's take the case of the origins of the Palestinian refugees in 1948. Up until, you could say, roughly the early to mid-1980s, there was a dominant, I hate these postmodern words, so I'm not going to use discourse. There was a dominant viewpoint on how the Palestinians became refugees in 1948. Anybody who's roughly of my age cohort or above will, of course, remember that explanation. It was the famous Arab radio broadcasts that the neighboring Arab countries, the leaders of the neighboring Arab countries, instructed the Palestinians to leave in 1948 to clear the field for the invading Arab armies. And after the invading Arab armies successfully threw the Jews into the sea, then the Palestinians would be able to return.
What did you say?
So, as I was saying, the standard interpretation or the standard explanation among mainstream scholarship was that the Palestinians fled on account of the Arab radio broadcasts. As a matter of fact, it was already well known for those who wanted to know. It was already well known that that was factually insupportable. Already by the early 1960s, there were a couple of scholars, one Irish by the name of Erskine Childers and one Palestinian by the name of Vali Khalidi, and they went back and they checked exactly what was on those Arab radio broadcasts. Because in 1948, that region of the Middle East had been heavily monitored by intelligence agencies, American, British, and so forth, and they recorded all the Arab radio broadcasts. A couple of folks, as I said, Childers and Khalidi, listened to the broadcasts and then went through the newspapers of the time, and they found no record of these Arab radio broadcasts instructing the Palestinians to leave. Even though it was known for those who wanted to know, if you looked at the literature, the scholarly literature of the time, it basically repeated the claim about the Arab radio broadcasts. Come the late 1980s, a number of historians who came to be called the new historians, mostly but not entirely Israeli, they themselves began to research the newly opened Israeli archives, and they reached a conclusion. The conclusion has basically two aspects to it. Everyone now agreed that the Palestinians had suffered an ethnic cleansing in 1948. That was no longer a topic of dispute. So you can take somebody who's quite mainstream now, someone like Benny Morris. He wasn't then, but he is now, a quite mainstream Israeli historian. He'll acknowledge the Palestinians suffered an ethnic cleansing in 1948. And you can take historians to the left of him, and they, of course, will make a similar claim. There was still a debate, and there still is a debate, namely, on whether the ethnic cleansing was merely a byproduct of war, namely in the midst of a wartime situation, refugees are generated, or whether it had been the result of premeditation. That debate remained, but the question of whether or not it was an ethnic cleansing, that already was agreed upon. So the range of disagreement, the range of dispute on the range of disagreement and dispute on what happened in 1948 had significantly narrowed. Now, if it's true, as I argue, in the historical record, there is a broad consensus on what happened to the Palestinians or what happened in the last 120 years. When we come to the human rights questions, in fact, there's not just a broad consensus, but there's a consensus full stop. As many of you probably know from just visiting the internet, there's a huge number of human rights organizations which monitor what goes on in Israel and Palestine. You have, first of all, the large international organizations like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. Then you have the local organizations in Israel like B'Tselem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories. Then you have the Israeli-based organizations like the Public Committee Against Torture in Israel. Then you have the local affiliates of international organizations like Physicians for Human Rights Israel. Then you have the Palestinian human rights organizations. It's a large number. And they all put out a large number of publications, now numbering probably in the thousands of pages for, say, the period since the First Intifada. For something that I was writing, I had occasion recently to read through those thousands of pages of human rights reports. And what was most striking when you read through the reports is they basically agree on everything. Now, that's quite remarkable. They agree on everything, notwithstanding two facts. First of all, human rights law is international human rights law is still very much in its infancy. And accordingly, there are lots of disagreements about how you interpret or how you apply the human rights law in particular situations. So one would expect that these human rights organizations would disagree on questions of how do you apply the human rights covenants and agreements. Secondly, a lot of the human rights reports deal with specific incidents. What happened at that crossing at that hour? Who started firing first, the Israeli soldiers or the Palestinians? That's what a lot of the human rights reports deal with, detailed questions. And everybody who's familiar with the famous Japanese film Rashomon knows that five people can see the same incident and walk away with five different interpretations. So what is so surprising is, even though the human rights law is in many respects quite nebulous, and even though people just see the same incident often differently, if you look through the human rights reports, I was able to find, in literally thousands of pages of human rights reports, I was only able to find one relatively trivial incident where two human rights organizations disagreed on anything. In fact, on questions of theory, on questions of detail, on questions of practice, there's no disagreement at all. And that raises again the same question. If it's true within the historical scholarship, there's relatively little disagreement. There's an area, but pretty narrow. And if it's true on the human rights questions, there's no disagreement at all, then why so much controversy and passion, which occasionally even ignites in this room in this or that moment? Why are people so angry about a topic on which it seems nearly everybody who's read the record, nearly everybody agrees? And that's the topic I want to look at. I want to first look at the area of what I would call legitimate disagreements among those who follow or who are concerned about the topic. Areas where I think legitimate people, areas in which decent people can honestly disagree, and where the adage, we have to agree to disagree, has application. So let's take the question of those refugees again. You can agree on the factual question, but still disagree on the moral and political question. It doesn't necessarily follow from agreeing on the facts that you render the same ethical or moral judgment. Now we have a young woman here who she hears moral and ethical judgment, and she's thinking, it's so beautiful outside, why am I listening to this? So I'm going to try to make it concrete what it means. Let's take a historian like Benny Morris. Morris, as I said, acknowledges that the Palestinians suffered an ethnic cleansing in 1948. They were thrown out of their homes and weren't able to return. However, Morris, having acknowledged the factual question, reaches an altogether different moral judgment than, say, many people in this room. He says, yes, it's true, factually, the Palestinians were ethnically cleansed in 1948. But morally, he says, I think it was a good thing. He says, some ethnic cleansings serve a useful purpose. He says, for example, the great American democracy, meaning the United States, he says the great American democracy couldn't have been created were it not for, and now I'm using his word, were it not for the annihilation of the indigenous population. And so the annihilation was a good thing. It made possible the great American Republic. In the same way, he says, the Palestinian ethnic cleansing in 1948, it was an ethnic cleansing, but he says it was a good thing. In fact, he says the main error that the Israelis made in 1948, their main mistake was that they hadn't cleansed all of Palestine of its indigenous population. He said they should have cleansed the area, they should have cleansed the area of Palestine that became Israel of its Arab population, what we now call the Israeli Palestinians. And he says they should have cleansed also the West Bank and the Gaza. And had they done so in 1948, we wouldn't have the problems that we do today. Now, you can't say Morris is wrong. It's not a factual question. It's a moral question. And you can say his moral judgment is a Nazi moral judgment, and I think it is, but you can't, I think, in fairness, say it's a wrong moral judgment. It's a different moral judgment. Or you can take the case, for example, of Professor Alan Dershowitz of Harvard in his book called Chutzpah, which he claims is an autobiography. In Chutzpah, he mentions the question of the Palestinian refugees as well. And he says, yes, they were expelled in 1948, but he says, now I'm quoting him, ethnic cleansing, and now I'm using his word, he says, it's a fifth-rate human rights issue, analogous to what he calls, and again I'm quoting him, massive urban renewal. That it's a fifth-rate, it's a trivial issue, equivalent to massive urban renewal. Again, I don't think you can call that a wrong moral judgment. You can call, or I should say, you can't call it an incorrect moral judgment. I think you can fairly call it a demented one, but not an incorrect one. And now you come to a second problem. People can even share agreement on the historical facts, They can agree on the moral question. They can agree on the legal question, but still reach altogether different political conclusions. I said a moment ago that it's possible to agree on the factual question, agree on the moral question, agree on the legal question, and still disagree on the political question. And some of you may be surprised at that. So let's go from the abstract to the concrete. Let's turn back to those Palestinian refugees again. Take someone like Professor Chomsky. He acknowledges that the Palestinians were ethnically cleansed in 1948, no longer a matter of historical dispute. He acknowledges that morally it was an abomination. He acknowledges that legally Palestinians have the right of return under international law. He acknowledges... Well, I think you're going to be disappointed, because he also thinks politically it's infeasible and Palestinians should not fight for that right. He agrees on the moral question, he agrees on the legal question, but he has a different political judgment. He says it's unrealistic. There's no issue here of right and wrong. He says, in his view, it's not realistic, it's infeasible, and that in fact, he says, it's immoral to dangle in front of Palestinians the hope of return when it's not practical. It's not a practical possibility. Now, there are many people in this room who probably disagree. And that's why I said, I think this is one question where people can fairly agree to disagree. It's a legitimate difference. It's a political judgment. You look at the facts, you look at the array of forces in the world, the likelihood that this demand can be won, this demand can't be won, and you make an assessment, a judgment. Human beings are fallible. His judgment may be wrong. Or human beings are fallible, and those who are fighting for the right of return, their judgment may be wrong. I think we simply have to acknowledge that in politics there are areas of judgment where decent people can agree or should agree to disagree. And that's one area. Having said that, I would still have to stress one point. That point being that even though there are areas of legitimate disagreement among those who are struggling for the rights of Palestinians to their basic human rights, even though there are areas of disagreement politically, the fact of the matter is, the broad picture for how to resolve the conflict, once again, on that broad picture, there is a consensus. It's not particularly complicated. Most of you in the room are familiar with it. Again, whether you agree or disagree, the consensus for the past 30 years has been for a two-state settlement, with Israel withdrawing from the territories it occupied in the June 1967 war, Palestinians having the right to exercise their rights to self-determination in the West Bank and Gaza, and the neighboring Arab states, as well as the newly born Palestinian state, are recognizing Israel's right as a state in the region to secure borders and the right to live in peace. That's been a consensus that's endured for the last 30 years or so, with two crucial exceptions, namely the United States and Israel. So let's just take a couple of examples. In 1989, the two-state settlement is put before the United Nations General Assembly, and the vote is 151-3. 151 countries favoring the two-state settlement, three countries opposing it. The three are the United States, Israel, and the island state of Dominica. That's it. There were no abstentions. There were 154 countries in the world at that time. There were no abstentions, and there were no absentees. Now, if you move up to the year 2004, a 15-year period has elapsed, but in many ways, a historically significant period. Between 1989 and 2004, in the first place, a whole social system disappeared. The Soviet-type system collapsed in 1989. A whole social system disappeared. And in addition, many states were now born. About 40 states were born between 1989 and 2004. The current number of states in the UN is 191. In 1989, it was 154. So you had vast political changes in the world's map, and you had vast geographical changes in the world's map. The borders changed dramatically. What's very striking is, notwithstanding what one could call legitimately these world historic changes, the consensus for the two-state settlement has remained absolutely consistent and firm. So if you look at the voting record in the United Nations, every year the UN passes a dozen or so resolutions on the question of Palestine, ranging from relatively trivial things like scholarships for Palestinian refugees to funding UNRWA, the main organization working in the refugee camps, to bigger political questions like the two-state settlement. If you look at the voting record on all of these questions, it's always, always the whole world here, usually depending on the vote, it'll be 160 or some countries, and there are always just 8 dissents. And you can check for yourself. So the whole world favors a two-state settlement, and then you have the 8 dissenters. And the 8 dissenters are the United States, Israel, the Federated States of Micronesia, the Marshall Islands, Nauru, Palau, and Tuvalu. 7. That's it. That's it. Every year, it's Nauru, Palau, Tuvalu, Micronesia, Marshall Islands, the United States, and Israel. For those of you who don't know what Nauru, Palau, and Tuvalu are, rest assured, I teach the topic and I didn't know what they were either. For those of you who don't know, Nauru's main export is bird droppings. Tuvalu is disappearing because of global warming. And I can't remember what's Palau's main claim to fame. What? Dessert?
Sir?
Yeah. Okay.
After the lecture.
Okay. Having said that much, that there is a broad consensus on the scholarship, on the human rights, and also on how to politically resolve the Israel-Palestine conflict, I now come to the heart of my remarks tonight, namely, what accounts for that, those outbursts of passion and vehemence on the topic. And as I said, the main argument I'm going to make is most of it is just concocted, contrived, falsified in order to divert and confuse people. The first kind of illegitimate or contrived controversy around the Israel-Palestine conflict, I would call the attempts to mystify it, to claim that it's so complicated, it's so profound, it's so unique, that it's kind of the humanities equivalent of rocket science and particle physics. that it's impenetrable to the eye of the layperson or those who only have a general knowledge of the topic. Sometimes we're told that it's at the heart of a conflict of civilizations, a cosmic conflict of religions, that it can't be compared to any other conflict. And in fact, I don't think, looking at the historical record, it's very complicated at all. What's very striking when you look through the historical record on the Israel-Palestine conflict is everybody writing about it, either contemporary observers or historians, don't find any particular complexity at all in the Israel-Palestine conflict. Let me give you a couple of examples. As most of you know, for the first half of the 20th century, Palestine was under the stewardship, what it was called, a mandate of the British. And from the beginnings of the Zionist movement, there were constantly rebellions and revolts in Palestine opposing the prospect of turning Palestine into a Jewish state. And every time there was a major rebellion, the British would send over a parliamentary investigative group to figure out what's going on. And the British were very professional. Their reports, of which there are many, the reports are all very excellent, and they stand up over time. They reward or repay reading even now. And the most famous of them, some of you will know, is the Peel Commission report, which came out of the Arab Revolt from 1936 to 1939. When you read through the Peel Commission report, what's very striking is in the historical sections, they keep using the word obviously, or it's obvious. Obviously, obvious, it's obvious what's happening here. They said it's obvious that the Palestinian Arabs are angry because all the other states which were carved out after World War I, all the other states were being granted or would soon be granted independence. The only exception was Palestine. And so the Palestinians were angry that the rights of self-determination, which were being afforded all the neighboring Arab states, were being denied the Palestinians. The British said, that's obvious. And they go on to say, it's obvious that they're afraid if the Jews come in too large numbers, when the Palestinians are granted independence, it'll be a Jewish state and not a Palestinian state. They said, that's obvious. They said there was nothing, no special requirements of knowledge to understand why the Palestinians were rebelling. In fact, they went on to say, it's perfectly obvious why they hate all Jews. Because the Jews who are coming to Palestine, the only ones they know, all those Jews are determined to turn their homeland into a Jewish state. They said it's obvious that they would hate them for that. Not complicated at all. Okay, some of you may say, well, what do you expect from the British? So let's take someone like Israeli historian. Let's take someone like the one I mentioned earlier, Benny Morris. In 2000, or 1999, he published a very fat book called Righteous Victims, The Origins of the Arab Zionist Conflict Over Palestine. And now it's pretty much a standard textbook in many college classes teaching the topic. At one point, he has to account for Palestinian resistance to Zionism. And he writes, the fear of territorial dispossession and displacement was to be the chief motor of Arab antagonism to Zionism. the fear of territorial displacement and dispossession was to be the chief motor of Arab antagonism to Zionism. Now, some of you are no doubt wondering, well, what's so important about that? And why did he repeat it twice? But when I saw that phrase in the book, it practically, or we should say metaphorically, leapt off the page for me. Why? Notice what he doesn't say. He doesn't say it was anti-Semitism that was the chief motor of Arab antagonism to Zionism. He doesn't say it was religion. He doesn't say it was fear of Enlightenment values. He doesn't say it was envy of Europeans. No, we don't need all of these exotic, complicated explanations. The explanation for why the Palestinians resisted Zionism is very straightforward and very obvious. Let's take a comparable situation, relatively comparable. No analogy is perfect, but if an analogy illuminates significant similarities, then it's useful. Let's take the case of Native Americans and their resistance to Euro-American encroachment. Now, if we're not going to be too politically correct about it, we know or should know that the Native American resistance to the Europeans was very bloody. It was very brutal. The Native Americans killed men, they killed women, they killed children. It was a horror. Of course, it was a horror on the other side as well. But acknowledging the horrors inflicted by the Euro-American settlers, we shouldn't deny the fact that the Native Americans resisted in quite bloody, sanguinary fashion. However, having acknowledged that fact, what would we think if a historian comes along and says, the reason the Native Americans resisted the Euro-American encroachment was because of anti-Europeanism or anti-Christianism or anti-whiteism? Well, you would laugh. Why would you laugh? Because you don't need these exotic explanations. The obvious explanation, to paraphrase Benny Morris, the fear of territorial displacement and dispossession, the obvious explanation also happens to be a sufficient one. We don't have to call on complicated explanations. The purpose of the complicated explanations is to sow confusion, to throw doubt on your native judgment. This is wrong. It's plainly wrong, and it's not a particularly complicated wrong. Often it's said, you can't compare. The fancy Latin expression is, this conflict is sui generis, which means you can't compare it to any other. There's a reason why you're not supposed to compare. Because if you make the obvious analogies, you compare what happened to the Palestinians with what happened to the Native Americans. Or currently, you compare the situation to occupied territories with apartheid in South Africa. When you make the comparisons, Israel comes out on the wrong side of the analogy. That's why you're told not to compare. The second kind of false or contrived disagreement or controversy surrounding the Israel-Palestine conflict is the attempt to exploit the colossal suffering that Jews endured during World War II to play the Holocaust card. And the Holocaust, whole issue of the exploitation of the Nazi Holocaust for this purpose is rather complicated, and given the limitations of time, I can't discuss it at the length that the topic merits. So I'm just going to refer to a certain number of relevant points which during questions and answers I'll be happy to fill in on. The first two points, the most crucial points, which I think are not known either to older audiences or better known to older audiences, certainly not known to younger people, is that, and it'll come as a surprise, I think, to many of you, neither Israel nor the Nazi Holocaust, neither Israel nor the Nazi Holocaust played any significant role in American Jewish life or American life generally until the late 1960s. In the case of Israel, I'll discuss each of them in turn. In the case of Israel, there was a lot of anxiety among American Jewish leaders about the creation of the State of Israel, for good reason. Jews have always been strapped with the stereotype of the double loyalty, namely they're loyal to their people and to their states, that they have two loyalties as against one. And that's always been a burden that Jews have had to bear, threatening or questioning their loyalty to the states in which they live. It'll come as a surprise to many of you who know about the Balfour Declaration. The Balfour Declaration, meaning the statement by the British government supporting the establishment of a Jewish national home in Palestine. But it will come as a surprise to many of you to know that the main opponents of the Balfour Declaration were Jews. The British Jews like Montefiore, Montague, Wolfe, prominent British Jewry, was very worried. They were worried that they now had achieved success in British society, and if this Jewish state were created, the anti-Semites would tell them to leave. And so they campaigned very hard against the Balfour Declaration. In the same way, after World War II, American Jewry had anxiety because not only did there already exist this claim about a double Jewish loyalty, but now this claim seemed to have an institutional reality. There was a state out there calling itself a Jewish state, and it was claiming that the first loyalty of all Jews belonged to that state. And so American Jewish leaders were very uncomfortable with this state which was now calling itself their state, happening exactly at the time where American Jewry is beginning, to use the famous expression of Norman Podhoretz, when American Jewry was beginning to make it in the United States. And then it was compounded by a second fact. Remember, we're in the midst of the Cold War. The anti-communist hysteria, and in fact, the leadership of the Jewish state, as well as many of its social experiments, look kind of leftist, if not communist. The kibbutzim was a communist experiment. The main dissenting party in Israel, the Mapam, was slavishly loyal to the Soviet Union. The leadership called itself socialist. So now you have a second problem. Not only do you have a Jewish state, but you have a quasi-communist Jewish state in the midst of the McCarthy era. So American Jews are very cautious about this new state called Israel. If you read the literature on the topic from the 1950s, Israel is barely mentioned at all. Among American Jewish intellectuals now furiously and passionately pro-Israel, virtually none of them had anything at all, I mean literally zero, to say about Israel. In fact, it'll come as a paradox to some of you, a surprise, that there are only two Jewish intellectuals in the United States, only two, in the 1950s, who were publicly identified with Israel. One, only a handful of you will note, so I won't have time to go into it, though it's an interesting example. One was Hannah Arendt. And the second was Noam Chomsky, who was a Zionist from a young age, he says from the time of five, and still claims he is a Zionist, was raised. Chomsky was a Zionist from an early age, still says he is, he was, as far as I can tell, along with Hannah Arendt, the only two public Jewish intellectuals identified with Israel. I'll give you, in any event, even if you take the case of the foremost Jewish publication of the time, and perhaps to a lesser extent today, Commentary Magazine, the editor of Commentary Magazine up until, or at the time, up until 67, let's just get exactly right. In 1966, the editor of Commentary Magazine writes a book called Making It. And it's about how he made it as a prominent Jewish intellectual in American society. He's the editor of Commentary Magazine. It's right on the eve of the June 1967 war. If you pick up the book, as I did several years ago, to look at for the first time, you'll find that there's only one passing reference to Israel, just a couple of words referring to some argument that occurred in the 1950s. It didn't exist at all. Israel enters the domain of, or the terrain of American Jewish life, and American life generally, only after the June 1967 war, when Israel proves itself to be a formidable strategic asset for the United States, and now the United States embraces Israel, and at the time the United States embraced Israel, so does American Jewry, and they become these born-again Zionists, fanatical supporters of Israel. I think it's an important point to keep in mind, because there's always this assumption that Jewish loyalty to Israel is a tribal loyalty or a national loyalty based on a common sense of community. The record doesn't show that at all. The record shows the American Jewish elites embraced Israel when it was politically convenient to embrace Israel and not before. In the same way, it'll come as a surprise to many of you, younger people in particular, to know that the Nazi Holocaust played next to no role in American Jewish life until the late 1960s. The reasons why are, again, pretty straightforward, but it's a political reason, and you really have to understand politics to understand how these loyalties unfold. We're now at the end of the 1940s. The United States enters into a major political alliance with West Germany. West Germany is the main anchor of U.S. power in Europe. Well, apart from the uppermost tier of West German power, namely Adenauer and a couple of people around him, the West German regime is mostly ex-Nazis. In the bureaucracy, in the professions, academia, the legal profession, the medical profession, it's all Nazis. Well, it had to be all Nazis for a very simple reason. Germany is divided after World War II. If you were on the left, you went to the east. If you were on the right, you went to the west. And so the whole West German government is stacked with former Nazis. And because of that, you weren't allowed to mention the Holocaust. because mentioning the Nazi Holocaust was seen as undermining the U.S. West German alliance. It was seen as playing into the hands of the communists, because it was the Soviet Union that opposed that U.S. West German alliance. And for that reason, American Jewry hushed the Nazi Holocaust. Don't talk about it, because if you talk about it, you're going to be accused of being a leftist and a communist and an agent of the Soviets. And in fact, it was true in the 1950s. The only ones who honored the memory of the Nazi Holocaust were those on the communist left. I'm not saying their reasons were always noble. That's just a factual point. In fact, it's very striking. It'll come as a surprise to many of you to know. Up until the late 1960s, in the English language, there were only two scholarly studies on the Nazi Holocaust. One by a fellow named Gerald Reitlinger, and the second, the most famous, by Raoul Hilberg, The Destruction of the European Jews. And Hilberg wrote a memoir. It's quite interesting. He said, I'm in Columbia University. It's in the 1950s. He has a very famous scholar as his mentor, his thesis advisor, a fellow by the name of Franz Neumann. And he goes to Neumann and he says to him, I want to write my doctoral dissertation on what he called the destruction of the European Jews during World War II. And Neumann said, don't do it. You'll never get a job. As it happens, Hilberg, to his great and eternal credit, did do it, produced an enduring work of scholarship. But that was the atmosphere back then. Now, the conservative estimate is there are close to 10,000 scholarly studies on the Nazi Holocaust. Well, what happened? As I said to you earlier, beginning in the late 1960s, Israel is now the strategic asset of the US, and now becoming the strategic asset, the American Jewry, Israel, and the American government too, begin to use the Nazi Holocaust as a club to silence all criticism of Israel. It becomes an ideological weapon. And the main form of the weapon is familiar to everybody here, I'm sure. It's the claim that no one in the history of humanity has ever suffered the way Jews suffered during World War II. And the claim then became, if Jewish suffering is unique, then you can't apply to Jews the same moral standards as you would to any other country. So if Israel is occupying territory in defiance of international law, what about the Holocaust? If Israel's systematically torturing Palestinian detainees, what about the Holocaust? If Israel is the only country in the world that uses house demolitions as a form of punishment, what about the Holocaust? And the Holocaust became a weapon, truth be told, a quite effective weapon, to silence all criticism of Israeli policy. The most recent form of this Holocaust weapon is what's called, and everybody I'm sure has heard it, is what's called the new anti-Semitism. And there are two things about the new anti-Semitism which are worth bearing in mind. Number one, it's not new. And number two, it's not about anti-Semitism. What do I mean? First of all, roughly every 15 years, Israel's apologists play the new anti-Semitism weapon. I don't mean that figuratively, I mean that literally. Whenever I go to lecture at a university, the first question I ask of the person who invited me is, how's the library? And I was told you have a reasonable, though not a terrific, library. DePaul has a wretched, where I teach, it has a wretched library. But almost every library, if you just take down these names, Arnold Forster, F-O-R-S-T-E-R, and Benjamin Epstein. In 1974, they put out a book. The book is called, I wish I had the title, the cover for you, it's called The New Anti-Semitism. Forster and Epstein were the heads of the Anti-Defamation League, the B'nai B'rith Anti-Defamation League, which some of you may know is the main Jewish defense organization. It specializes in defaming the character of anyone who criticizes Israel. There is in 1981, the new head of the Anti-Defamation League is a fellow named Nathan Perlmutter. And in 1981, Nathan Perlmutter and his wife, Ruth Ann Perlmutter, they put out a book. And the book is called The Real Anti-Semitism. And what's its thesis? Its thesis is there's a new anti-Semitism. It's a roughly on 15-year cycles. Whenever Israel comes under huge international pressure to withdraw from occupied territories, they start with the new anti-Semitism roadshow. In fact, what's really striking about all this talk about a new anti-Semitism, not only at the general formulaic level, but even in the details, everything old is new again. So you take 1974 and you open up the Forster and Epstein book, and a main piece of evidence they present, they adduce for the new anti-Semitism, a main piece of evidence they come up with is this Broadway show that's just been turned into a movie. It's Jesus Christ Superstar. And they say it's an anti-Semitic production, and the lyrics of the musical are laden with anti-Semitism. The film was produced by Norman Jewison, and who was not Jewish, but prior to producing Jesus Christ Superstar, he had produced that other well-known anti-Semitic production, Fiddler on the Roof. We all know that anti-Semitic lyric, "If I Were a Rich Man." Now, the lyricist for Jesus Christ Superstar, he came in for a lot of trouble. He was a raving anti-Semite, they said. The lyricist was Andrew Lloyd Webber, who went on to produce other well-known anti-Semitic productions like Cats, which it said was a code reference to the Cats family. And the evidence for a new anti-Semitism, the evidence for it now is, in fact, a flat zero. I don't have time now to go through the whole record, though without sounding like I'm plugging a book, in a forthcoming book, I go through the whole record. I'll give you a couple of examples. We all hear about this raging, rampant anti-Semitism in Europe. Well, there is, as some of you know, the most respected survey organization in the United States is called Pew, the Pew Research Foundation. And a year after the last American aggression against Iraq, Pew went to Europe to survey European opinion a year after the aggression against Iraq. And they came to the unsurprising conclusion that most Europeans hate the US government. Well, you didn't need a very sophisticated polling organization to figure that one out. But they had heard all of this talk about a new anti-Semitism. So they posed some questions and did some surveying on that issue. And lo and behold, what did Pew find? It found that not only was there no evidence of a new anti-Semitism, not only was there no evidence of a new anti-Semitism, they found that as compared to 1991, when they last posed the question, there was actually a diminishing, a lessening of anti-Semitism in Europe. Let's turn to the case of the United States. We hear often about this raging anti-Semitism on college campuses. That's a big claim frequently made by the ADL and kindred organizations. First of all, for anybody who's been to a university, teaches at a university, or knows about university life, they know it's practically an impossibility. For better or for worse, universities are now so oppressively politically correct that you can't say anything in any way, indirectly, offending or insulting someone without the deans, this organization, that organization. You have to have meetings, conferences. Everybody has to sit around, hold hands, sing kumbaya. It's the idea of arranging anti-Semitism, racism, anything-ism on college campuses is just flat out preposterous. Let's look at the evidence. There have been a lot of claims made about anti-Semitism on this campus, that campus, and that campus. Let's look at the most recent example, because the most recent example is in many ways the most illuminating. As many of you in the room know, the most recent hysteria was fomented at Columbia University. The claim that there was rampant, raging anti-Semitism at Columbia. Local politicians called for professors to be fired. Newspapers called for the professors to be sacked. So much pressure came on the university president that he had to appoint an investigatory body. He appoints the body, and it meets for several months, and it hears witnesses, 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 witnesses. And then it puts out its report. The report's quite interesting for a couple of reasons. Number one, remember, Columbia's the test case. Here you had an investigative body checking all the claims, and you had the newspapers, you had the media, you had politicians closely watching every move. What did they come up with? They came up with exactly one instance where a professor perhaps reacted heatedly when a student tried to defend Israeli actions during Operation Defensive Shield in Jenin. That was it. One instance where one professor reacted heatedly. And I will tell you an interesting footnote. That was it. Finally, the case is placed under a microscope. You can't imagine the kind of hysteria in New York over this raging anti-Semitism at Columbia. They come up with this one instance. In the one instance, the student, her name is Dina Shanker, she brings in one student and one outsider who she says was in that class that day, who claimed the incident happened. The professor, Joseph Massad, he brought in two assistants, preceptors, I use the word, what do they call them now? Teaching assistants, right. Two teaching assistants and several students who said it didn't happen. The university investigative body decides that the complaint was credible. I was unsure what happened. On the one hand, I know from teaching that if you have a scene and you tell a student to leave, it is not forgotten. Every student remembers what happened. The fact that she could only find one fellow student who could testify to what happened made me suspicious. On the other hand, I couldn't believe that Columbia would certify the incident unless it had solid evidence. And so, again, I'm mentioning it, and forgive me, in the forthcoming book, I decided to credit the claim of the Columbia University investigative body, and I said there was one probably credible incident that happened. And then what happened last week? Last week, 20 students from that class, because the class was in 2002 and now they're scattered all over the world, 20 students got together and on their own took an initiative and they wrote a letter to the president of Columbia. And it's a mixed group, Jewish, non-Jewish, American, non-American. You can see the letter, it's posted on Joseph Mossad's website. What do they say? A, it never happened. It said, we were students in that class, we were all there, we remember the day, it didn't happen. He never told her to leave, he never got heated in his response, and they called on the Bollinger's committee, the committee he appointed, and that he said, what they concluded, the 20 students said, what the committee concluded was not true. That was really striking. The best case they could come up with of this new anti-Semitism, the best case, the most documented, exhaustively examined case since they started with this new anti-Semitism hysteria, and they came up with exactly flat zero. No evidence at all. Nothing. That's the new anti-Semitism. Let me now turn, and I'll conclude on this remark, let me turn to the third form of diversion, confusion on the Israel-Palestine conflict. And speaking to a university audience, many of whom are young people who take scholarship and learning seriously, as they ought to, this third aspect of the confusion and diversion is in many ways the most dispiriting of all. Namely, there is this vast, virtually uncontrolled proliferation of sheer nonsense and fraud on the Israel-Palestine conflict. A ceaseless flowing of just sheer lies and sheer nonsense. I began my remarks with the Joan Peters case, and now we have another case in many ways quite similar to it. Before I get to that case, I want to just say a couple of things about how academia supposed to work and ideally does work. Namely, in academic life, we're supposed to have reasonably accurate mechanisms of quality control that enables us to know what's nonsense and what's not, what we should put heed in and what we should ignore. Now, nobody's going to claim that these mechanisms are perfect. On the other hand, in general, they work. Some of you hear mechanisms of quality control and you tune out. They're not complicated at all. What are the mechanisms of quality control? Somebody comes along and says, I just read a book and the book said, and the person recites a fantastic thesis bordering on the preposterous. Now, if you're an academic, you're naturally skeptical to begin with. So when you hear that claim, your eyes will squint a little, transmitting the skepticism, and you'll say, the first question often is, who published that book? Because you know there are what we call quality publishers, where the books are what's called peer-reviewed. That means recognized scholars in the field have to read the book and approve it before it gets published. So you have quality publishers, and then you have what we can call, at the other extreme, vanity publishers, where people pay to get their book published. So the first question you'll put is, who published the book? A second question you might ask is, who blurbed the book? That is, who wrote a comment on the back praising the book? That's why most scholars, when they pick up a book, the first thing they do is flip to the back to see who's written a comment for it. A third question you might ask is, what kinds of reviews did that book get? And you name a quality journal, maybe the New York Review of Books, or maybe a professional journal. And the fourth question you might ask is, what does that professor teach? And you attach a higher value if he teaches at a recognized institution, or and a lesser value if she teaches at a not as esteemed institution. I'm not saying the mechanism is perfect, but generally speaking, after having put that sequence of questions to someone, you get some sense of whether or not to attach value to the publication and the thesis. The problem is, when it comes to the Israel-Palestine conflict, all of those mechanisms collapse. Let's take an example, a hypothetical. You have a book, it's published by John Wiley and Sons, a very respectable publishing house. The blurbs for the book, they're excellent. There's one from Floyd Abrams, the leading civil liberties lawyer in the United States. Another one from Mario Cuomo, the former esteemed governor of New York State. And so on down the line. Then the review gets excellent reviews. In the New York Times, their leading expert on the Times editorial board, a fellow by the name of Ethan Bronner, he writes an excellent review for the book. The Boston Globe, a fellow named Jonathan Dorfman, writes an excellent review of the book. And then, well, who's the author? It's not from an obscure community college in El Paso, Texas. The author is the senior most professor of law at Harvard Law School, the Felix Frankfurter Chair at Harvard. Excellent publisher, excellent blurbs, excellent reviews, excellent academic pedigree, and yet the book can be, and in this case is, a flat-out fraud. It's a hoax. In fact, amazingly enough, large parts of the book are plagiarized from another hoax. He plagiarizes Joan Peters's From Time Immemorial. Now, that's pretty shameless, you have to admit, to not only plagiarize, but plagiarize from a hoax. In fact, every substantive claim in the book, every substantive claim in the book is a flat-out lie. Not an error, not an exaggeration, not an exercise in hyperbole, a flat-out lie. Now, for some of you, that's a bit difficult to believe. And I'll explain why it has to be the case. For those of you who have looked at the book, anyone here look at the book? Okay, good. If you take a look at the back of the book, there are the endnotes. And what's very striking about the endnotes for the book is the following. Dershowitz writes in the case for Israel that Israel's human rights record is, and now I'm quoting, generally superb. Now, everybody knows that if you want to know the human rights record of any country, you go to the mainstream human rights organizations. What do they have to say? So a gentleman earlier mentioned the Sudan. If somebody wants to know the human rights situation in Sudan, they typically go to Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and assorted human rights organizations. It's the standard place to go. What's very striking about Dershowitz's book, a large chunk of it, chunk of which is devoted to human rights, is not once does he ever cite one mainstream human rights organization, international, Israeli, Palestinian, to support any of his claims. He cites Amnesty to attack it. He cites B'Tselem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in Occupied Territories, to attack it. But never once, despite the thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of documentation, he never once cites any human rights organization to support his claim. Why? Obviously, if he could have, he would have. It enhances the credibility of your claim. That's why the person interested in Sudan goes to a credible source like Human Rights Watch. The reason he doesn't cite them is not because he doesn't want to cite them. He doesn't cite them because he can't cite them. Just as Peters's claim that Palestine was empty on the eve of Zionist colonization was preposterous, and she had to fabricate and falsify sources to prove it, in exactly the same way Dershowitz's claim that Israel's human rights record in occupied territories is generally superb, it's equally preposterous, and he has to resort to preposterous sources or falsify sources, or, in his case, fabricate sources in order to prove his point. That should tell us two things. Number one, as I said at my introductory remarks, it took me about 6 months to research the Peters hoax. It then took me a very long time to expose it. In the same way, I began systematically to go through Alan Dershowitz's book. And in all honesty, it took me a relatively short time to produce a relatively large manuscript. And that was, again, the easy part. Because the hard part was, the moment Professor Dershowitz found out that I had produced the manuscript, he embarked on a campaign to try to suppress it. My original publisher was New Press, and he started bombarding them with these lengthy, single-spaced letters, trying to get them to desist from publishing the book. For reasons which I can't go into now, I then switched publishers and went to University of California Press at Berkeley. And they too were then overwhelmed with Dershowitz's letters. To their credit, they stood their ground. Dershowitz then hired the most powerful law firm in the country, Cravath, Swain, and Moore. He hired them to send letters to University of California Press to try to suppress publication of the book. Again, to University of California Press's credit, they held their ground. He then went to the Terminator. He went to Governor Schwarzenegger to try to suppress publication of the book. And that didn't succeed either. And with all good fortune, the book, although now held up 5 months due to libel lawyers, should be coming out in August. But the most important lesson. The most important lesson, no, it's an important lesson, I should say, for the people at UC Press, and to their credit. But the important lesson is, to my thinking, the following. They, that side, they have lots of power. No question about it. They have money, they have organization, they have political clout. They have lots of power. But our side has also a very powerful weapon. In fact, we have two powerful weapons. Our weapons are truth and justice. And to our good fortune, the truth and the justice, and it's important to keep in mind, the truth and the justice, okay, the truth and the justice are no longer hidden in dark corners and no longer inaccessible. The truth and justice are right out there. They're on the Amnesty International website. They are on the Human Rights website. They are on the B'Tselem website. They're on the Public Committee Against Torture in Israel website. They are on the Physicians for Human Rights in Israel website. It's right out there. And yeah, on the UN websites, that's correct. And if we learn to wield those weapons, if we learn how to wield the weapons of truth, I am fully confident that we can win. The truth, justice, it drives the other side into a panic. If we learn how to use those weapons, I think victory is possible. Thank you.